This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of A Wizard of Earthsea by Ursula K. Le Guin, narrated by Robert Inglis.
Only in silence the word, only in dark the light, only in dying life. Bright the hawk's flight on the empty sky. The Creation of Ea. Chapter 1. Warriors in the Mist. The island of Gaunt, a single mountain that lifts its peak a mile above the storm-wracked northeast sea, is a land famous for wizards. From the towns in its high valleys and the ports on its dark, narrow bays, many a Gauntish man has gone forth to serve the lords of the archipelago in their cities as wizard or mage, or, looking for adventure, to wander working magic from isle to isle of all Earthsea. Of these, some say the greatest, and surely the greatest voyager, was the man called Sparrowhawk, who in his day became both dragon lord and archmage. His life is told of in the deed of Ged and in many songs, but this is a tale of the time before his fame, before the songs were made. He was born in a lonely village called Ten Alders, high on the mountain at the head of the Northward Vale. Below the village, the pastures and ploughlands of the vale slope downward level below level towards the sea, and other towns lie on the bends of the river Aar. Above the village, only forest rises ridge behind ridge to the stone and snow of the heights. The name he bore as a child, Dooney, was given him by his mother, and that and his life were all she could give him, for she died before he was a year old. His father, the bronze-smith of the village, was a grim, unspeaking man, and since Dooney's six brothers were older than he by many years, and went one by one from home to farm the land, or sail the sea, or work as smith in other towns of the Northward Vale, there was no one to bring the child up in tenderness. He grew wild, a thriving weed, a tall, quick boy, loud and proud and full of temper. With a few other children of the village, he herded goats on the steep meadows above the river springs, and when he was strong enough to push and pull the long bellow sleeves, his father made him work as smith's boy, at a high cost in blows and whippings. There wasn't much work to be got out of Dooney. He was always off and away, roaming deep in the forest, swimming in the pools of the river Aar, that, like all Gauntish rivers, runs very quick and cold, or climbing by cliff and scarp to the heights above the forest, from which he could see the sea, that broad northern ocean where, past Perigal, no islands are. A sister of his dead mother lived in the village. She had done what was needful for him as a baby, but she had business of her own, and once he could look after himself at all, she paid no more heed to him. But one day, when the boy was 7 years old, untaught and knowing nothing of the arts and powers that are in the world, he heard his aunt crying out words to a goat, which had jumped up onto the thatch of a hut, and wouldn't come down. But it came jumping, when she cried a certain rhyme to it. Next day, herding the long-haired goats on the meadows of High Fall, Dooney shouted to them the words he had heard, not knowing their use or meaning, or what kind of words they were.
"Noth yerth malk man, yolkan merth han."
He yelled the rhyme aloud, and the goats came to him. They came very quickly, all of them together, not making any sound. They looked at him out of the dark slot in their yellow eyes. Dooney laughed and shouted it out again, the rhyme that gave him power over the goats. They all came closer, crowding and pushing round him. All at once he felt afraid of their thick, ridged horns, and their strange eyes and their strange silence. He tried to get free of them and to run away. The goats ran with him, keeping in a knot around him, and so they came charging down into the village at last, all the goats going huddled together as if a rope were pulled tight round them, and the boy in the midst of them weeping and bellowing. Villagers ran from their houses to swear at the goats and laugh at the boy. Among them came the boy's aunt, who didn't laugh. She said a word to the goats, and the beasts began to bleat and browse and wander, freed from the spell.
"Come with me,"
she said to Duni. She took him into her hut, where she lived alone. She let no child enter there usually, and the children feared the place. It was low and dusky, windowless, fragrant with herbs that hung drying from the cross-pole of the roof, mint and moly and thyme, yarrow and rushwash and paramal, kingsfoil, clovenfoot, tansy and bay. There his aunt sat cross-legged by the fire-pit, and looking sidelong at the boy through the tangles of her black hair, she asked him what he had said to the goats, and if he knew what the rhyme was. When she found that he knew nothing, and yet had spellbound the goats to come to him and follow him, then she saw that he must have in him the makings of power. As her sister's son, he'd been nothing to her, but now she looked at him with a new eye. She praised him, and told him she might teach him rhymes he would like better, such as the word that makes a snail look out of its shell, or the name that calls a falcon down from the sky.
"Aye, teach me that name," he said,
being clear over the fright the goats had given him, and puffed up with her praise of his cleverness. The witch said to him,
"You will not ever tell that word to the other children if I teach it to you. I promise."
She smiled at his ready ignorance.
"Well and good, but I will bind your promise. Your tongue will be stilled until I choose to unbind it, and even then, though you can speak, you will not be able to speak the word I teach you where another person can hear it. We must keep the secrets of our craft."
"Good," said the boy, for he had no wish to tell the secret to his playmates, liking to know and do what they knew not and could not. He sat still while his aunt bound back her uncombed hair and knotted the belt of her dress, and again sat cross-legged, throwing handfuls of leaves into the fire-pit, so that a smoke spread and filled the darkness of the hut. She began to sing. Her voice changed sometimes to low or high, as if another voice sang through her, and the singing went on and on until the boy didn't know if he waked or slept, and all the while the witch's old black dog that never barked sat by him with eyes red from the smoke. Then the witch spoke to Duni in a tongue he didn't understand, and made him say with her certain rhymes and words until the enchantment came on him and held him still.
"Speak,"
she said to test the spell. The boy couldn't speak, but he laughed. Then his aunt was a little afraid of his strength, for this was as strong a spell as she knew how to weave. She had tried not only to gain control of his speech and silence, but to bind him, at the same time, to her service in the craft of sorcery. Yet even as the spell bound him, he had laughed. She said nothing. She threw clear water on the fire till the smoke cleared away, and gave the boy water to drink, and when the air was clear, and he could speak again, she taught him the true name of the falcon, to which the falcon must come. This was Duni's first step on the way he was to follow all his life, the way of magery, the way that led him at last to hunt a shadow over land and sea to the lightless coasts of Death's kingdom. But in those first steps along the way, it seemed a broad, bright road. When he found that the wild falcons stooped down to him from the wind when he summoned them by name, lighting with a thunder of wings on his wrist like the hunting birds of a prince, then he hungered to know more such names, and came to his aunt begging to learn the name of the sparrow-hawk and the osprey and the eagle. To earn the words of power he did all the witch asked of him, and learned of her all she taught, though not all of it was pleasant to do or know. There is a saying on Gaunt, "Weak as woman's magic," and there is another saying, "Wicked as woman's magic." Now the Witch of Ten Alders was no black sorceress, nor did she ever meddle with the high arts or traffic with old powers. But being an ignorant woman among ignorant folk, she often used her crafts to foolish and dubious ends. She knew nothing of the balance and the pattern which the true wizard knows and serves, and which keep him from using his spells unless real need demands. She had a spell for every circumstance, and was forever weaving charms. Much of her lore was mere rubbish and humbug, nor did she know the true spells from the false. She knew many curses, and was better at causing sickness, perhaps, than at curing it. Like any village witch, she could brew up a love potion, but there were other, uglier brews she made to serve men's jealousy and hate. Such practices, however, she kept from her young prentice, and as far as she was able, she taught him honest craft. At first all his pleasure in the art magic was childlike, the power it gave him over bird and beast, and the knowledge of these. And indeed that pleasure stayed with him all his life. Seeing him in the high pastures, often with a bird of prey about him, the other children called him Sparrowhawk, and so he came by the name that he kept in later life as his use name, when his true name was not known. As the witch kept talking of the glory and the riches and the great power over men that a sorcerer could gain, he set himself to learn more useful lore. He was very quick at it. The witch praised him, and the children of the village began to fear him, and he himself was sure that very soon he would become great among men. So he went on from word to word and from spell to spell with the witch, till he was 12 years old, and had learned from her a great part of what she knew. Not much, but enough for the witch-wife of a small village, and more than enough for a boy of 12. She had taught him all her lore in herbals and healing, and all she knew of the crafts of finding, binding, mending, unsealing and revealing. What she knew of chanters' tales and the great deeds she had sung him, and all the words of the true speech that she had learned from the sorcerer that taught her, she taught again to Dooney, and from weather-workers and wandering jugglers, who went from town to town of the northward vale and the east forest, he had learned various tricks and pleasantries, spells of illusion. It was with one of these light spells that he first proved the great power that was in him. In those days the Kargat Empire was strong. Those are four great lands that lie between the northern and the eastern reaches. Karego At, Atwan, Hur At Hur, At Nini. The tongue they speak there is not like any spoken in the archipelago or the other reaches, and there are savage people, white-skinned, yellow-haired, and fierce, liking the sight of blood and the smell of burning towns. Last year they had attacked the Torricals and the strong island Torhaven, raiding in great force in fleets of red-sailed ships. News of this came north to Gaunt, but the lords of Gaunt were busy with their piracy and paid small heed to the woes of other lands. Then Spivey fell to the Kargs and was looted and laid waste, its people taken as slaves, so that even now it is an isle of ruins. In lust of conquest the Kargs sailed next to Gaunt, coming in a host, 30 great longships, to East Port. They fought through that town, took it, burned it. Leaving their ships under guard at the mouth of the River Aar, they went up the vale, wrecking and looting, slaughtering cattle and men. As they went they split into bands, and each of these bands plundered where it chose. Fugitives brought warning to the villagers of the heights. Soon the people of Ten Alders saw smoke darken the eastern sky, and that night those who climbed the high fall looked down on the vale all hazed and red-streaked with fires, where fields ready for harvest had been set ablaze, and orchards burned, the fruit roasting on the blazing boughs, and barns and farmhouses smouldered in ruin. Some of the villagers fled up the ravines and hid in the forest, and some made ready to fight for their lives, and some did neither, but stood about lamenting. The witch was one who fled, hiding alone in a cave up on the Capading Scarp, and sealing the cave-mouth with spells. Dooney's father, the Bronsmith, was one who stayed, for he wouldn't leave his smelting pit and forge where he had worked for 50 years. All that night he laboured, beating up what ready metal he had there into spear points, and others worked with him, binding these to the handles of hoes and rakes, there being no time to make sockets and shaft them properly. There had been no weapons in the village but hunting bows and short knives, for the mountain folk of Gaunt are not warlike. It is not warriors they are famous for, but goat-thieves, sea-pirates, and wizards. With sunrise came a thick white fog, as on many autumn mornings in the heights of the island. Among their huts and houses down the straggling street of Ten Alders, the villagers stood waiting with their hunting bows and new-forged spears, not knowing whether the cogs might be far off or very near, all silent, all peering into the fog that hid shapes and distances and dangers from their eyes. With them was Dooney. He had worked all night at the forge bellows, pushing and pulling the two long sleeves of goat-hide that fed the fire with a blast of air. Now his arms so ached and trembled from that work that he couldn't hold out the spear he had chosen. He didn't see how he could fight or be of any good to himself or the villagers. It rankled at his heart that he should die, spitted on a cargish lance, while still a boy, that he should go into the dark land without ever having known his own name, his true name as a man. He looked down at his thin arms, wet with cold fog-dew, and raged at his weakness, for he knew his strength. There was power in him, if he knew how to use it, and he sought among all the spells he knew for some device that might give him and his companions an advantage, or at least a chance. But need alone is not enough to set power free. There must be knowledge. The fog was thinning now under the heat of the sun, that shone bare above on the peak in a bright sky. As the mists moved and parted in great drifts and smoky wisps, the villagers saw a band of warriors coming up the mountain. They were armoured with bronze helmets and greaves and breastplates of heavy leather and shields of wood and bronze, and armed with swords and the long cargish lance. Winding up along the steep bank of the Aar, they came in a plumed, clanking, straggling line, near enough already that their white faces could be seen, and the words of their jargon heard as they shouted to one another. In this band of the invading horde there were about 100 men, which is not many, but in the village there were only 18 men and boys. Now need called knowledge out. Dooney, seeing the fog blow and thin across the path before the cogs, saw a spell that might avail him. An old weather-worker of the Vale, seeking to win the boy as prentice, had taught him several charms. One of these tricks was called fog-weaving, a binding spell that gathers the mists together for a while in one place. With it, one skilled in illusion can shape the mist into fair, ghostly seemings, which last a little and fade away. The boy had no such skill, but his intent was different, and he had the strength to turn the spell to his own ends. Rapidly and aloud he named the places and the boundaries of the village, and then spoke the fog-weaving charm. But in among its words he enlaced the words of a spell of concealment, and last he cried the word that set the magic going. Even as he did so, his father, coming up behind him, struck him hard on the side of the head, knocking him right down. "Be still, fool! Keep your blattering mouth shut, and hide if you can't fight." Dooney got to his feet. He could hear the cogs now at the end of the village, as near as the great yew-tree by the tanner's yard. Their voices were clear, and the clink and creak of their harness and arms, but they couldn't be seen. The fog had closed and thickened all over the village, greying the light, blurring the world, till a man could hardly see his own hands before him. "I've hidden us all," Dooney said sullenly, for his head hurt from his father's blow, and the working of the doubled incantation had drained his strength. "I'll keep up this fog as long as I can. Get the others to lead them up to High Fall." The smith stared at his son, who stood wraith-like in that weird, dank mist. It took him a minute to see Dooney's meaning, but when he did, he ran at once, noiselessly, knowing every fence and corner of the village, to find the others and tell them what to do. Now, through the grey fog, bloomed a blur of red, as the cog set fire to the thatch of a house. Still they didn't come up into the village, but waited at the lower end till the mist should lift and lay bare their loot and prey. The tanner, whose house it was that burned, sent a couple of boys skipping right under the cog's noses, taunting and yelling and vanishing again like smoke into smoke. Meantime the older men, creeping behind fences and running from house to house, came close on the other side and sent a volley of arrows and spears at the warriors, who stood all in a bunch. One cog fell writhing with a spear, still warm from its forging, right through his body. Others were arrow-bitten, and all enraged. They charged forward then to hew down their puny attackers, but they found only the fog about them, full of voices. They followed the voices, stabbing ahead into the mist with their great, plumed, blood-stained lances. Up the length of the street they came shouting, and never knew they had run right through the village as the empty huts and houses loomed and disappeared again in the writhing grey fog. The villagers ran scattering, most of them keeping well ahead, since they knew the ground. But some, boys or old men, were slow. The cogs, stumbling on them, drove their lances or hacked with their swords, yelling their war cry, the names of the white god-brothers of Atuan. Wooloa! Hatwa! Some of the band stopped when they felt the land grow rough underfoot, but others pressed right on, seeking the phantom village, following dim wavering shapes that fled just out of reach before them. All the mist had come alive with these fleeting forms, dodging, flickering, fading on every side. One group of the cogs chased the wraith straight to the high fall, the cliff's edge above the springs of Ar, and the shapes they pursued ran out onto the air and there vanished in a thinning of the mist, while the pursuers fell screaming through fog and sudden sunlight 100 feet sheer to the shallow pools among the rocks. And those that came behind and didn't fall stood at the cliff's edge, listening. Now dread came into the cogs' hearts, and they began to seek one another, not the villagers, in the uncanny mist. They gathered on the hillside, and yet always there were wraiths and ghost shapes among them, and other shapes that ran and stabbed from behind with spear or knife and vanished again. The cogs began to run, all of them, downhill, stumbling, silent, until all at once they ran out from the grey blind mist and saw the river and the ravines below the village all bare and bright in morning sunlight. Then they stopped, gathering together, and looked back. A wall of wavering, writhing grey lay blank across the path, hiding all that lay behind it. Out from it burst two or three stragglers, lunging and stumbling along, their long lances rocking on their shoulders. Not one carg looked back more than that once. All went down, in haste, away from the enchanted place. Farther down the northward vale those warriors got their fill of fighting. The towns of the East Forest, from Ovark to the coast, had gathered their men and sent them against the invaders of Gaunt. Band after band they came down from the hills, and that day and the next the cogs were harried back down to the beaches above Eastport, where they found their ships burnt. So they fought with their backs to the sea till every man of them was killed, and the sands of Armouth were brown with blood until the tide came in. But on that morning in Ten Alders village, and up on the high fall, the dank grey fog had clung a while, and then suddenly it blew and drifted and melted away. This man and that stood up in the windy brightness of the morning, and looked about him, wondering. Here lay a dead carg with yellow hair long, loose, and bloody. There lay the village tanner, killed in battle like a king. Down in the village, the house that had been set afire still blazed. They ran to put the fire out, since their battle had been won. In the street, near the great yew, they found Dooney, the bronzesmith's son, standing by himself, bearing no hurt, but speechless and stupid like one stunned. They were well aware of what he had done, and they led him into his father's house, and went calling for the witch to come down out of her cave and heal the lad who had saved their lives and their property, all but four who were killed by the cogs, and the one house that was burnt. No weapon hurt had come to the boy, but he wouldn't speak, nor eat, nor sleep. He seemed not to hear what was said to him, not to see those who came to see him. There was none in those parts wizard enough to cure what ailed him. His aunt said, "He has overspent his power." But she had no art to help him. While he lay thus dark and dumb, the story of the lad who wove the fog and scared off Cargish swordsmen with a mess of shadows was told all down the northward vale, and in the east forest, and high on the mountain, and over the mountain, even in the great port of Gaunt. So it happened that on the fifth day after the slaughter at Armouth, a stranger came into Ten Alders village, a man neither young nor old, who came cloaked and bareheaded, lightly carrying a great staff of oak that was as tall as himself. He didn't come up the course of the Aar like most people, but down, out of the forests of the higher mountainside. The village goodwives saw well that he was a wizard, and when he told them that he was a heal-all, they brought him straight to the smith's house. Sending away all but the boy's father and aunt, the stranger stooped above the cot where Dooney lay, staring into the dark, and did no more than lay his hand on the boy's forehead and touch his lips once. Dooney sat up slowly, looking about him. In a little while he spoke, and strength and hunger began to come back into him. They gave him a little to drink and eat, and he lay back again, always watching the stranger with dark, wondering eyes. The bronzesmith said to that stranger, "You are no common man." "Nor will this boy be a common man," the other answered. "The tale of his deed with the fog has come to Rhealby, which is my home. I've come here to give him his name, if, as they say, he hasn't yet made his passage into manhood." The witch whispered to the smith,
"Brother, this must surely be the mage of Rhealby, Ogion the Silent, that one who tamed the earthquake."
"Sir," said the bronzesmith, who wouldn't let a great name daunt him, "my son will be 13 this month coming, but we thought to hold his passage at the Feast of Sun Return this winter."
"Let him be named as soon as may be," said the mage, "for he needs his name. I have other business now, but I will come back here for the day you choose. If you see fit, I'll take him with me when I go thereafter, and if he prove apt, I'll keep him as prentice, or see to it that he's schooled as fits his gifts. For to keep dark the mind of the mage-born, that is a dangerous thing." Very gently Ogion spoke, but with certainty, and even the hard-headed smith assented to all he said. On the day the boy was 13 years old, a day in the early splendour of autumn, while still the bright leaves are on the trees, Ogion returned to the village from his rovings over Gaunt Mountain, and the ceremony of passage was held. The witch took from the boy his name Dooney, the name his mother had given him as a baby. Nameless and naked he walked into the cold springs of the Aar, where it rises among rocks under the high cliffs. As he entered the water, clouds crossed the sun's face, and great shadows slid and mingled over the water of the pool about him. He crossed to the far bank, shuddering with cold, but walking slow and erect as he should through that icy, living water. As he came to the bank, Ogion, waiting, reached out his hand and, clasping the boy's arm, whispered to him his true name, Ged. Thus was he given his name by one very wise in the uses of power. The feasting was far from over, and all the villagers were making merry with plenty to eat and beer to drink and a chanter from down the vale singing the deed of the dragon lords, when the mage spoke in his quiet voice to Ged.
"Come, lad, bid your people farewell and leave them feasting."
Ged fetched what he had to carry, which was the good bronze knife his father had forged him, and a leather coat the tanner's widow had cut down to his size, and an alder stick his aunt had becharmed for him. That was all he owned, besides his shirt and breeches. He said farewell to them, all the people he knew in all the world, and looked about once at the village that straggled and huddled there under the cliffs, over the river springs. Then he set off with his new master through the steep, slanting forests of the mountain isle, through the leaves and shadows of bright autumn.